7BR Part Heard.
Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. This week, I'm joined by Elaine Banton to discuss the recent Supreme Court decision in the Queen on the application of Zed and Another and Hackney London Borough Council and Another, as well as a look back at the last 10 years of the Equality Act and examining where there's room for improvement in the future. Elaine has specialised in employment and discrimination law from the outset of her career and is regularly instructed in high value and complex trials by private companies, public sector bodies, charities and individuals. Her practice also includes disciplinary, regulatory, sports law, human rights, harassment and stress at work claims. She speaks and writes regularly on her specialist areas of law for various practice publications. She is, for instance, co-author of the chapter on human rights and employment law for Tolly's Employment Law. Elaine is co-chair of the Bar Council's Equality, Diversity and Social Mobility Committee, was elected bencher at Middle Temple in March last year, and was a finalist for the First 100 Years Inspirational Woman of the Year Award for Barrister of the Year 2019. Elaine, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
In the recent case of R and Hackney London Borough Council and Agudas Israel Housing Association, the Supreme Court held that restricting allocations of social housing to members of a particular religious community was lawful. What was the factual background to this case?
The factual background to this case is that the AIHA was a charitable housing association providing social housing primarily to people in the Orthodox Jewish community living in Hackney. In particular, the housing association provides social housing for members of the Haredi Jewish community. The housing association offers accommodation via an online portal operated by Hackney Council. And the council provides access to the online portal for people identified as having a priority need for housing. The practice was that they nominated members of the Orthodox Jewish community for the housing association's properties. This was due to the council being unable to compel the housing association to offer accommodation to people outside of the particular Orthodox Jewish community. In any event, there was a significant surplus need for social housing in the Orthodox Jewish community within Hackney. The appellant, Zed, was a single mother with four small children, and the council decided that she did have a priority need for a larger property. However, the allocation of the larger property in question to Z and her family took longer than it otherwise would have done because she was not Orthodox Jewish, and therefore she wasn't eligible for one of the housing association's properties. She then issued legal proceedings against the council and the housing association, alleging unlawful direct discrimination under the Equality Act. Zed lost her case at the first instance and also in the Court of Appeal. It was then heard by the UK Supreme Court. I have a particular interest in this case, not just because of the legal issues under the Equality Act, including positive action, but also because I grew up in Hackney. And I also had a part-time job working amongst the Jewish Orthodox community at a GP surgery in Stamford Hill.
Now, this housing allocation policy was accepted as being an act of direct discrimination. So to a layperson, it might be surprising that it was found to be lawful. So I was wondering if perhaps you could explain what exemptions were at play and how the court reached the conclusions that it did.
Yes, there are permissions under the Equality Act that will exempt and allow this situation to be lawful. So in particular, Section 158 allows positive action to address in a proportionate manner the needs or disadvantage connected to a particular protected characteristic. There's also some further permissive sections. Section 193, subsection 2, subsection A, allows a charity to restrict benefits to persons with a protected characteristic if to do so is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Section 193(2)(b) allows a charity to restrict benefits to a person with a protected characteristic if to do so seeks to prevent or compensate for a disadvantage linked to that characteristic. So it was found at first instance by the Divisional Court that the housing association's policy of restricting housing allocations to the Orthodox Jewish community was a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, which was to minimise disadvantages and discrimination experienced by the Orthodox Jewish community in the private housing market.
And as part of this approach, the Supreme Court confirmed that charities can utilise what they called bright line criteria in their decision-making processes. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the bright line criteria effectively means that in the context of state provision of social welfare benefits, it's a legitimate approach and it's in accordance with the principle of proportionality to use this criteria to govern their availability. That means that the state is entitled to focus on particular groups for the provision of social welfare benefits, even though there may be little or no difference at the margins in terms of the need between some particular individuals in the first group compared to another group. It is found to be justified because it minimises the costs of administration of a social welfare scheme. And also, it may be the best way of ensuring that resources are efficiently directed to the group which overall needs them the most.
What was the significance of the argument raised in relation to the race directive?
Well, this was quite interesting because this argument came very late in the day, and you could readily infer from the Supreme Court judgment some annoyance at the lateness of this argument. However, it was allowed to proceed, which is interesting in itself. But the argument was basically constructed that to allow this provision offended against the race directive and so would be unlawful. But what the Supreme Court held was that, in fact, they couldn't rely on the race directive because the permission, the exemption in this case, wasn't based on race. It was based on religion or religious belief or religious observance, and that is not prohibited by the race directive. So on that basis, it wasn't contrary to the race directive. However, there is potentially an argument raised by this issue, which is, could an argument be put on the basis of the race directive had the exemption been based on race clearly and squarely? That is subject to a further decision. But however, I would see that the arguments over proportionality and positive action exemptions coming into play. So ultimately, it may not lead to a difference in the conclusion. However, it's interesting that this argument was raised in this way.
Now, this year marks 10 years of the Equality Act. What did the law look like before it?
Well, we had different acts before. We had a sort of Equality Act in play. We had the Sex Discrimination Act, Race Relations Act, Disability Discrimination Act. So the law was rather piecemeal and lacked a degree of cohesion. And so I think that was one of the reasons why we wanted to draw it all together.
The accompanying guidance to the Act states that it is a single act making the law easier to understand and strengthening protection in some situations. Do you think that it's achieved its aims?
To an extent, I think it has achieved its aims. It certainly draws the types of claims together. It lays out the landscape in a more cohesive fashion. Some areas, I think, were strengthened and clarified better. So I think it has gone some way to making those improvements, but there's also still a long way to travel, in my opinion.
Of the many important Equality Act cases of the last decade, I know it's probably a really horrible question, but is there any one or any particular subsection of the development of case law which you found particularly interesting or ones which stand out in your mind, perhaps?
You've asked me a really interesting question, so I'm going to have a look at a few different points in answering it. I think I have to mention the behemoth of the equal pay claims, which are still going on. I think those are very interesting and they have far wide-reaching repercussions to industry and the workplace in general. I think indirect discrimination litigation is very, very interesting indeed. I think we are much more aware of how practices or rules that are operated can lead to disparity, that's disparate impact amongst different communities and groups. And indirect discrimination can actually be used to combat structural or systemic inequalities or institutional inequalities where they become embedded. It's not a perfect match between structural inequalities and the Equality Act, but it does work. For example, in a workplace where you might see there are no women or ethnic minorities employed above a certain level. So you might want to think about, how does that promotion work? Is there some rule or practice that's operating that prevents that progression? Is it open and transparent, or is it an opaque system in operation? And the case of ESOP and the Home Office, which was a Supreme Court decision in 2017, does go some way to expand how such claims may be brought. Because in that case, there was a disparity in that Black candidates were disadvantaged in the examination, which was called the Core Skills Assessment, which was a prerequisite to promotion to certain civil service grades. They found that there was a disparity. They couldn't explain why, but it was still indirect discrimination. So I think that is an interesting development that can be used to really advance indirect discrimination claims. But I would also have to suggest that the Section 15, discrimination arising from disability claims, have been pivotal as new claims under the Equality Act for discrimination related to disability. The relationship of showing unfavourable treatment, which once a claimant shows that, shifts the onus on the employer to show that there is proportionality. Again, there are many claims that have utilised this section. And I've seen many in my own practice, because I've always done a lot of discrimination claims and always done a lot of disability discrimination claims. But there's one particular case in my own practice which relied on this section and went all the way to the Court of Appeal, where we were successful in the case of O'Brien versus Bolton St Catherine's Academy. And that was a case which did show that in particular circumstances, claimants were able to be protected by Section 15 of the Equality Act, even where they had been off work for a substantial long period of time. There was still a very clear duty for an employer to show adverse impact from that absence from work where it was related to the disability in question. So that, for me, I think Section 15 line authority is a very interesting development under the Equality Act.
Amongst all these important developments, though, as you mentioned, there is still a long way to travel. And it seems as though some of the potential of the Equality Act hasn't yet been fully realised, not least because successive governments have not commenced the socioeconomic duty under Section 1 of the Act. So where do you think there is still room for improvement, and what sort of changes would you like to see?
Yes, I mean, let's start with Section 1 of the Act. What better place to start but the first section that was never enacted? And this was, as you refer, the socioeconomic duty. It was a public sector duty, and it's never come into play. Potentially one of the changes in the Act that could have had the most impact across society, but never enacted. So certainly it would be interesting to see how that could affect change in society if it was actually enacted. So that's certainly one that I'd flag up. I'm also interested in the concept of multiple or compound discrimination. Under the Equality Act, I'm seen as a woman who is Black. Two separate characteristics, two separate claims, two separate strands. When in reality, I'm a Black woman and there's intersectionality there. It's also much more the case that how we see each other in society, in the world at large, is in the round as a Black woman, as opposed to a woman who is Black. So why not reflect this in the Equality Act? It seems to me a more nuanced approach would be preferred. And I cannot see the disadvantages of actually legislation reflecting what is happening in society. I do not see any drawbacks from having that more compound or multiple type of discrimination enacted under the Equality Act. I'd also refer to the fact that third-party discrimination was removed, and that this, I think, was an important piece of protection that I'd like to see resurrected for employees in the workplace, because you do see lots of employees, particularly in service-type industries, who are subjected to harassment from third parties. And so it can be very difficult for them to be protected. And so I think third-party discrimination is an important step. I also think that the public sector equality duty, which is a duty owned by public bodies like local authorities, where they have a positive duty to promote equality, I think that there is scope for better use of this across all industries and sectors of society to bring about more accountability, whether it's employment, housing, education, etc., a better use of it to try and ameliorate disadvantage. Because as we know, the duty does talk about eliminating unlawful discrimination, harassment, victimisation and other conduct, and also the advancements of equality of opportunity between people who share a protected characteristic and those who do not, but also the fostering of good relations between people who share a protected characteristic and those who do not. So I think there is scope for more use of that public sector equality duty. And I'd also like to refer to the use of positive action, which we have already discussed in the case involving the housing allocation that went to the Supreme Court. Recently, there was the launch of the initiative of 1,000 Black Interns across many sectors of industry, including big city hitters such as law firms and investment houses. And this is an example of utilising lawful positive action, which in my experience, many employers are afraid of using, or they don't really understand how they can use it in a lawful, effective way. I would say to them, this is an example of how the initiative can work lawfully. Do your research within your business, your area. Look at things like mentorship, internship, work experience, because these initiatives can be used to bring about effective change. Also have a look at the McGregor-Smith review for how a government review actually talks about the effect on the workforce and flags up in particular that £24 billion could be added to the economy if Black and ethnic minority talent was fully utilised. One way of advancing that is to look at positive action initiatives. And I would also say that we should have further consideration of the interplay between systemic inequalities and indirect discrimination, together with the public sector equality duty and promotion of equality, with better arguments for use, corrective, lawful use of positive action to bring about effective and meaningful change in the workplace.
It seems like the moral of the story is there is always more work to be done, and we'll be watching closely to see how the law develops in this way. Elaine, thank you very much for your time. We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. You can find more information and all our previous episodes on our website.